Herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen Episode Forward Thinkers. Mein Name ist Daniel Fürk und mein heutiger Gast ist Jeff Jarvis. Der US-amerikanische Journalist, Buchautor und Medienkritiker beschäftigt sich seit Jahrzehnten mit der Zukunft der Öffentlichkeit und mit den Gefahren, denen demokratische Gesellschaften ausgesetzt sind, wenn Medien, Politik und Technologie versagen. In dieser turbulenten Zeit warnt er mit großer Klarheit vor einer autoritären Verschiebung in den Vereinigten Staaten und kritisiert dabei nicht nur Donald Trump, sondern auch die Medienhäuser, die ihn gewähren lassen. Ich wollte von ihm wissen, warum ausgerechnet Komiker zu den letzten lauten demokratischen politischen Stimmen im Land geworden sind, wie gefährlich der Fall Jimmy Kimmel wirklich ist und ob die Demokratie der USA überhaupt noch zu retten ist. Wenn dir diese Episode von Forward Thinkers gefällt, folge uns bei Spotify, Apple Podcasts oder wo auch immer du gerne Podcasts hörst und hinterlasse uns eine gute Bewertung.
In an ever-changing world, we need to keep track of what will be next. Forward Thinkers is your 48 Forward podcast to discover the future. We are talking to innovative and creative minds from all over the world to learn more about what they are working on and what they think will change the way we work and live within the next decade. Are you ready to join the ride? Welcome to Forward Thinkers.
Jeff, wonderful to see you here, right out of the US, where crazy things are happening right now. But first of all, welcome to the show.
Vielen Dank.
To give a brief summary, what, from your point of view, are we seeing in the US right now when it comes to everything we learned about Jimmy Kimmel, everything we learned about Colbert months before, and now this... Yeah, kind of crazy quote from Donald Trump where he's saying like 97% of all media reports are against him. That's not free speech, but fraud. And that has to stop from his point of view.
We are seeing nothing less than America's fall into fascism. And we are seeing, from our perspective as media people, the complete and utter failure of the American institution of journalism to recognize that, to label it, to explain it, to cover it, to judge it. I spent 50 years of my long life in journalism, and I now have regrets because the failure of the institution is devastating, I think. I'm seeing better coverage of America's state in German media than I do in American media right now. I write occasionally to my friend Jochen Wegner, the now co-editor of Die Zeit, begging for pieces to be translated. Just this week, there was one in the Süddeutsche and one in Der Spiegel that I wanted to see translated so that the American audience can read them. We're not recognizing what's happening. The country is lost. My former colleague Masha Gessen has a column in the New York Times about seeing one's country disappear. They had that experience with Russia, and now with the United States. And I think they're right that that's what we're seeing happen. You put it all together, there is the so-called unified executive. That's a dictatorship. The Supreme Court and the courts and many of the courts underneath, it doesn't matter because the Supreme Court itself is bought. Congress is worthless. There is no check. There are no balances. At the same time, they are attacking the institutions of America that matter. Obviously voting because they want to stay in power. Also education because they want people to be ignorant. Also the law, both inside government and in legal firms, and finally media. And various companies have tried to bend the knee to Trump, never learning the lesson that when you give him something, he only takes more. So when the Ellison family, Larry and son David, who I call the mini Murdochs, took over Viacom and CBS, they've started instituting their right-wing views into CBS immediately. Now word has it that they're going to try to take over Warner Brothers Discovery, which includes CNN, and they're going to do the same thing there. At the same time, in a sweetheart deal done by Trump, they're going to take over TikTok alongside venture capitalist Mark Andreessen. So all of our media in the United States are either now owned and controlled by the right wing, rather like Hungary, or are so frightened of them and so willing to bend the knee as ABC has done in getting rid of Jimmy Kimmel for now, that's lost. And you'd hope that the internet would give us the opportunity through podcasts, through social media and such to dissent at least here. But Twitter is the organ of the far right. Zuckerberg has gone full Quisling with Facebook, Instagram, and Threads. TikTok, as I say, is about to be taken over by the far right, enough, which is bad enough that it makes me wish for Chinese management. And I see, frankly, no reason for hope.
I just had a conversation 2 weeks ago with Douglas Rushkoff talking about everything that's going on right now. And I asked him, why are all the tech bros and all the billionaires not standing up against Trump? And then he told me a little story about how especially people like Mark Zuckerberg or Elon Musk are constantly afraid of everything ending from one moment to another, all their power, all their money, all their influence. And that's why they are trying everything to keep themselves safe and don't really care about anything that is going on. What's your view on that?
Well, on the business side of life, we're living in a giant lie. My retirement funds are doing quite fine. The market's at records. The Wall Street Journal, Murdoch's bully pulpit, had a story the other day that CEOs, while in the open, are paying obeisance to Trump and saying everything is dandy. In private, they're grumbling and complaining and fearful. So we're not hearing the real thoughts because nobody wants to puncture the market. And I think that that leads to a complacency such that people aren't complaining. The tariffs, the Trump tax, has not yet fully hit the pocketbooks of Americans. The fact that we've lost a huge part of our labor force and more every day is having an impact, but is not fully yet felt. And so it's not just the tech CEOs, it's all the CEOs who are chicken shit.
So did we in the end put too much hope into ethics and moral and you know, coming over all what happened in my country, for example, we hope that everything will be fine now, but in the end, it's all about money, and money is what's going to change democracy in the U.S. or destroy democracy?
I think the fuller analysis in the U.S. is not money, but race. I'd be curious to hear your thoughts about this coming from Germany. I tell journalists often that they should read and reread Hannah Arendt and the lessons that she gained from both Germany and the Soviet Union. And I wonder where this ends in the U.S. In Germany, of course, it came to total destruction before a new society could be rebuilt from the ashes. In the United States, our Civil War never ended. This country was founded as a slave-holding nation. And the Senate and the Electoral College and our institutions were built around protecting those states and that institution. And even the Civil War, which brought us back together, the Reconstruction was ended. There were black people elected Congress and that ended, and voting rights ended. And we struggled and scraped our way back to the point that Lyndon Johnson passed the Civil Rights Bill to his political detriment. And now all of that is erased. The Supreme Court is erasing it wholesale. We can't even talk about diversity or equity in this country now. It's de facto illegal. And so the real analysis in this country, I think, has to come down to race. When you're running a fascist cult, as the Trumpists are, you have to have an enemy. And they can't out loud make that black people. They can't out loud make that Jewish people. They do out loud make that trans people and LGBTQ people, and especially they make that immigrants. So that becomes the generic brown-faced person who is suddenly the enemy that they create, that they're deporting, that's taking away jobs and is bringing crime and so on and so forth. It's a classic totalitarian view, and it's race. The analysis of what's happening in the United States, I think, must come to race.
It's pretty much the same what happened with Jews in the beginning of taking over of Adolf Hitler back then, because he kind of promoted himself as the hero who's actually saving the country from a danger that comes from those people. And yeah, he created that thought and he implemented that thought in German society. And because you just mentioned Hannah Arendt, I just wrote a book called Democracy Down, which is a thriller on how you can change public perception by just adjusting algorithms and taking over control about social networks and feeds and actually what is publicly visible and what not. And I put a quote of Hannah Arendt on the first page of that book, which is, "The ideal subject of totalitarian rule is not the convinced Nazi or the dedicated communist, but people for whom the distinction between fact and fiction and the distinction between true and false no longer exist." She wrote that back in 1951. And I think that's exactly what is happening in the US right now. Nobody is really digging deep enough to uncover more or less the facts beneath what certain people are promoting on their channels and in their interviews and talks and so on.
Arendt, we could quote Arendt all day, and we should. Arendt also said that she sees the roots of totalitarianism in loneliness, in people being alienated from their communities and from society, and that makes them vulnerable to the siren call of the cult and the totalitarian dictator. And she said one of the characteristics she puts on this is that people focus on abstract notions rather than real life. And in the United States, we have people concentrating on abstract notions like abortion and gun rights, as if that really is their primary concern in life every single day. And media then go along with that agenda, and they report this as if half of America is mortally concerned with the Second Amendment and abortion. I'm not to say that there isn't concern there, okay. But we don't go the next step of trying to understand people's everyday lives and everyday concerns about their families and their jobs and their communities. And as a result, media end up playing into the agenda set by the far right. When we talk in America about polarization and both sides things, that's where we end up moving the extreme toward the center, and we move the center to the right. And that's what's happened. And I'm terribly disappointed in the New York Times and especially the Washington Post now. They have not been doing their job.
So what I don't really understand right now, looking at the US, we've got people like Jimmy Kimmel. We've got people like Stephen Colbert, for example. They've got like a huge fan community all over the globe, actually, but especially in the US, of course. Why is, like, we already talked about, like, digital media and how they could have been, like, a hope for independent publishing and so on, getting rid of the networks and all the constraints connected to that. So why is Jimmy Kimmel not just going live on YouTube right the day after that decision to prove that he doesn't need a network to get out there?
Lawyers. Contracts. God knows what he's going through. I salute both Jimmy Kimmel and Stephen Colbert for their courage. They have been standing up better than Democratic leaders, better than journalists, better than universities. And that's what made them a target. If you're Jimmy Kimmel, it's a very difficult position, because if he tries to come back on the air, and he may be contractually obligated to do so, everything he says becomes suspect in terms of the control that may be attempted over him. ABC is now suspect. Disney is now suspect. Cancel your trips to Disney World, folks, though I don't think many Germans are coming to America these days for fear of what happens at the border. If he leaves, he gives up a lot. The people he employs are unemployed. He's in a terrible bind. He wanted to come on the air and say something about all this. I'm dying to know what he would have said. But they didn't. It's not just him. There's an analyst named Matthew Dowd, who's a former Republican, as far as I remember, who was fired by MSNBC because he said nothing. The moments after Charlie Kirk was shot, he just talked about, he was asked about the atmosphere in the country, and he talked about the atmosphere of extreme speech and extreme action. And that was too nerve-wracking. Kimmel didn't really say anything about Charlie Kirk at all. He did make fun of Donald Trump, which is his job. Don't we know that in the end, our last resort of dissent is humor? The ability to mock these leaders and what they do, and they're taking away that.
You know, it feels so strange for me, being someone who was digging deep into fascism, totalitarianism, and democracy and everything. And I always wanted to figure out how could stuff like that happen? Why is nobody standing up against it? Why is the whole society not powerful enough to end something like this? You know, you all could have voted differently, but in the end, as far as you realize what is really going on, why is there nothing happening? Are people really so afraid of what could happen if they would stand up that they are risking it all because they think it will not be as bad as we might think?
No, I don't think we're at that point of fear yet. I think worse, in a way, we're at a point of complacency, is that people are saying, give up, this is what this is. I wish there were more marches to go on. There have been bigger marches in Berlin than there have been in New York, about us, about Trump, and in the UK. So we're lacking leadership on that side. I mean, this is getting very much in the weeds of American politics, but we have Zoran Mondami, who's a phenomenal candidate for mayor in New York City right now, and the head of the Senate, the Democrats in both the Senate and the House have yet to endorse him, and they're from New York. What the hell are they thinking? They're running each other. I supported Kamala Harris as president eagerly from the beginning. She just wrote a book where she's running her bus over them and they're running their bus back over her. We need leadership right now and we don't have it. The comics were the best leaders we had. When Trump was elected, Jon Stewart held a giant rally about truth in Washington, D.C. the first time around. I think there are many of us who want to be convened and called together. But to go to the essence of your question, could we get to that point of fear? Yes. I was listening. There's a podcast in the U.S. This is Hannah Arendt Day, called Reading Hannah Arendt. The Hannah Arendt Center at Bard College and Roger Berkowitz read Arendt in a group and then discuss it. And I was listening to the podcast just last night of a next book about her book about revolution. And it finally dawned on me that this fetish about our Second Amendment and gun rights in the U.S., fatal to God knows how many children and how many Americans. The presumption was this was about the right wing wanting to be armed against the regime of Barack Obama and George Soros. I came to realize last night, listening to Arendt's words, that no, the plan all along was for them to be a disorganized militia not to fight against the government, but to fight in support of the government they ended up with. The government that is now in charge of the police and the army and the National Guard and our masked Gestapo goons in ICE. And we, the Democratic majority, small d and capital D, are not organized. We are not masked. We are not armed. So if it gets to a point of armed conflict in this country, of the civil war reemerging, we're screwed.
I was thinking a lot about the question why people are somehow not feeling that fear yet. We've just been talking about, maybe is it because Donald Trump is kind of a reality TV expert, more or less. He looks like a little bit clumsy. His language is like off, and somehow we don't really take him seriously. You know, if you look at someone like Adolf Hitler, he was screaming all the time. He was very dominant, and he had this very strong language, and also that didn't help in the end. But at the same time, if we look at Trump, he always looks clumsy and not really in a way to take him serious. Is that maybe exactly the problem? We are not afraid enough of Donald Trump. Is he maybe playing this whole game way too well?
So what's the essence of Donald Trump? Is he clever? I don't think so. I think he's stupid. I'm trying right now to find an essay that I read in a German newspaper just last week, and I can't find it right now. But one of the newspapers had an essay that made clear that Donald Trump is stupid.
Just plain stupid, I guess.
I think it was the Süddeutsche Zeitung. Yes, I think it was. I wish I could give credit to the writer right now. I think that's the case. I think that we keep on thinking that he has this magical political touch. He has this magical media touch. He has this magical sense of the heartland. No, he's Putin's useful idiot. That's what makes him useful. He's Peter Thiel's useful idiot and J.D. Vance's useful idiot. And that's what makes him useful. That's what makes him their stooge. And, you know, to watch him with foreign leaders is humiliating. I said that watching him in London looked like they were throwing a party for a rich five-year-old. We brought horses and drums and guns, right? And he loves it. And you watch the tables where everyone around the table has to praise him. He's that much of a simpleton. He is that much of an idiot. He is just stupid. So I think we make a mistake then in paying attention only to Donald Trump. We have to pay attention to those who are behind him. And that makes me sound like a conspiracy theorist. But so be it. It requires that larger analysis. But it's Claudius Seidel who wrote in the Süddeutsche, the genius of the idiot, if I translate that headline correctly. Our press won't even call him stupid. They dance around this. They look for magic. They look for it in a political sense. We must be missing something, because if half of America votes for him, well, half of America is an idiot. And I'm not supposed to say that. I'm supposed to understand. I'm supposed to listen. Well, the problem is, once again, we go back to once more Iran. If I listen to them, all they're going to spout is the Second Amendment and abortion. We're not going to have a real conversation. They're going to play back the signals that they give for their belonging in the cult. When people said during the election that Haitian immigrants were eating cats and dogs in Springfield, Ohio, I don't think they believed that when they told reporters and pollsters that. That wasn't the point. The point was to signal their belonging. If I can say even this, then I must belong. So that's the level at which we're having the discussion about Donald Trump, as if he is some magician, rather than he is the malign Chancellor Gardner. He is the malign idiot who now finds himself, because of television, because of mass media, in charge of the nation.
With all of what is happening right now, do you see any way to stop this? Is there, I had just a discussion with the former president of the Deutsche Bundestag, Wolfgang Thierse, and we talked about a difference between optimism and confidence, because optimism is just hope without doing something for a better outcome, and confidence needs your own action to actually make it better. So are you still confident that there is a way out?
No. And I wish that I were. I was on CNN this week, and frankly, they brought me on because I could say what the employees there could not say about the takeover of CNN. And I was full of depressing thoughts. I talked to a British podcast the next day, and I was full of depressing thoughts. I just last night wrote a post I haven't put up yet that is filled with depressing thoughts. And one would think when writing a blog post, as kind of the format of the blog post is, We're screwed. If only we do this, then we'll have the way out. I have the solution. I don't have the solution. I don't know. There's an inherent optimism, a hope, that there's a pendulum swinging and that it will swing back. Well, if it does, I fear that I'm too old to see it swing, that this is going to be going on for quite a while. And I fear for my children and the next generation. Could it swing? Maybe. Will that swing require the kind of destruction that Germany went through to cauterize the wounds to our democracy before it can be healed? I hope not, but I don't know. I see next to no strategy right now. The only practical strategy we have in the United States right now, Timothy Garton Ash wrote a column in The Guardian that was also translated and run in Germany. He translated because he's fluent. Saying last week that we have 400 days to save America. That is 400 days until our midterm elections. Well, it's now 396 days and counting. And I don't see the demonstrations. I don't see the leadership from the Democratic Party. I don't see the organization to bring us together to make sure that we can at least take over the House again. Now, that won't win everything. In fact, by then, there's so much damage done. Everybody who was decent and was fired or could quit in the government is gone. The Supreme Court is lost. The Senate is lost. Judges are appointed throughout the system for lifetime appointments. Laws are broken. The rule of law is gone. So having the House is cold comfort against all of that, but it could at least stop a few things. But in the next 400 days, Trump and company are, in case they do lose the House, they're going to do everything outrageous they could possibly do. And it is as if they wake up every morning saying, what horrible thing can we do today? And I know that sounds ridiculous, but they just woke up this week and said, we're going to stop studying hunger. We're going to stop the effort to cure cancer. We're going to get rid of not just the immigrant who's mowing our lawns, but the immigrant who's starting our companies and curing diseases. That just happened where he's trying to get rid of H-1B visa people who are necessary to technology companies and our economy, as well as universities and hospitals and elsewhere. They look around to say, what can we destroy for the sake of destruction? So they're going to be doing that as much as, because they're getting away with it. Everybody's letting them get away with it. Law firms, courts, media, universities are letting them get away with it. So they're going to keep going full steam ahead in ways we cannot yet imagine for the next 400 days. Meanwhile, we're sitting over here futzing on the side of democracy, not endorsing Zohran Mamdani, the one politician in this country right now who has people excited. No, I don't have much hope, confidence, or optimism for anything. I'm sorry.
What's your view on people like Gavin Newsom, who are kind of picking up the language Trump is using and doing a parody of it, more or less? Is that helpful, or is it just...
I think that the key to dealing with Trump is to mock him. That's why the comedians bother him so much. So Newsom is mocking him. And Newsom's doing a very good job of that. His people are doing an excellent job of that. And that's good to see. And he's taking actions. But at the same time, he came out praising Charlie Kirk. At the same time, we had too many of our Democratic politicians voting in Congress to praise Charlie Kirk. Charlie Kirk, I come back to German media once more. Der Spiegel put its famous documentation department on the question of whether Charlie Kirk is a right-wing extremist. And in a short and succinct piece the other day, they went through what he has to say about race and other topics and decided that, yes, he would be decreed in Germany a right-wing extremist, which I presume has legal implications as well there. But we don't do that here. And so you have this weird both sides thing going on where Gavin Newsom, on the one hand, is doing a good job of using entertainment and mockery against Trump. But then when push comes to shove, when it comes time to stand up and speak against bigotry and misogyny, he backs off.
In another interview, you warned that the real long-term target is education and universities, professors, even local school boards. What do you think? Are they really planning in such a long-term strategy? And why is that even more central than silencing journalists?
That's the long-term strategy, because that has impact for generations to come. Journalists come and go quickly, but education as an institution is the key to an enlightened society. And they are trying to drag America into a new dark ages. And they've done it over the years under our noses. Right here in my town in New Jersey, we had a school board that ended up with a few right-wing people on it, and they started killing textbooks, one of which they killed because it was mean to white people, honest to God. We did vote them out, but they could come back. And the point is not town by town. The point is that they had an organized scheme to take over school boards across this country. They had an organized scheme to take over television stations across this country. That's what played into yanking Jimmy Kimmel. They are attacking universities in ways that I couldn't believe possible, in ways that hurt the country, that take away research for, again, cancer. Because there is this again, effort for destruction's sake, and that includes even education and knowledge and science and medicine. Look at what Kennedy is doing to our health structure. It is a joy in chaos and destruction for its own sake. And it's, you know, the thing about it is we think that, oh, it's just the hoi polloi, the masses. Those are the people who are vulnerable to the dictator. But once more, to quote Hannah Arendt, she said that in Germany, the elites gladly stood there and watched the destruction, to watch it simply happen.
Yeah, because also I just had a conversation with a professor here in Eastern Germany, and we talked a lot about the right swing in politics in Germany, and how actually C-level people in big corporations are not really against that whole thing, because they kind of wish for a more authoritarian leader, someone who might be able to push economy and so on, because, you know, democracy always takes longer and is more complicated. And I think that's a big danger in the end, which is kind of leads us to the beginning of our conversation again, with all the television and network bosses and how they are acting right now.
American business is very short-sighted. You know, One of the great irony is that the stock market always does better under Democrats than under Republicans. Now, right now, the stock market is hitting records in spite of an economy that is very challenged. And it's because the economy is so screwed up and unemployment is going to get worse, which will lead to lower interest rates, and they like that. That's how short-term they are. Rather than thinking about whether the market here is healthy enough to keep buying more and more in our capitalistic consumer economy, they're thinking about the next meeting of the Federal Board of Governors and what the interest rate's going to be. So they think quarter to quarter. And now Trump is trying to get rid of quarterly reports, which on the left, we used to say, oh, they're too focused on the quarterly reports. But what Trump is really doing is he's trying to get rid of any source of credible information. So we can't trust anything. So he fires the head of the Bureau of Labor Statistics. He's trying to get rid of foreign correspondents, the German correspondents who were doing a good job covering America. Well, now he wants to cut their visas to 240 days. And businesses can't operate without good information. But again, they're very short-sighted. If the interest rate goes down and they can get money cheaper, hallelujah, that'll get me in the next quarter.
If you look at journalists right now in the U.S., what would be your advice to them? Do you have any recommendation how they should act right now, how they could stand up against their networks, against their C-level decision makers?
Well, first, I'll say it one more time. Read Hannah Arendt. The script is there. You can see what's happening, and you can see what's going to happen to you, point one. Point two, so I ran into an old friend the other day who kind of said he was debating whether to be blunt, because if he's going to get fired anyway, he might as well go out in a blaze of glory. I can't speak for anyone else. I'm old. I had a tenured position. I'm emeritus now. I live in a nice house. I'm white. I'm male. I sit from a position of privilege, a privilege that I should use to speak out. That's why I try to, in my little way, keep trying to do so. If you're a young employee in a news organization, I can't tell you what to do. I can't tell you that you should go marching into the editors of the publisher's office and telling them to go fuck off. But I guess I would say that the archive will judge you in the future. And every time the New York Times writes a prevaricating headline about how we're teetering near an edge that we're already over, they are writing the legacy of journalism by every individual action. So I would just encourage journalists, including my former students and graduates, to try at every turn to get as close as they can to telling the truth, to make it difficult for the bosses to cave. Journalists are pretty subversive that way. You know, one thing I did not say on CNN the other night, I wish I had afterwards, is I think that because it's a show where they have the right and the left yell at each other, and you all go in and yell at each other. It's not very productive, but that's the format. And there's this one guy on the right who everybody on the left cannot stand, but that's why he's paid reportedly more than $1 million there and be that character in a drama. And whatever I've said in the past that there isn't really liberal media, he sneers at me. Well, now the trope of liberal media is truly dead. There are liberals inside media, but media as an institution and an industry is now either owned by the Trumpists or frightened of the Trumpists. So all their bosses are scared shitless right now. All of their bosses are going to try not to get in trouble, and they're going to try to settle with the dictator. That's the reality the journalists are in. So I guess my friend is right. If you realize you're going to get fired anyway, then go out proud. But that's not for me to say. When you hit that moment and you know you're at that moment, judge your future, not your past.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
thank you for listening. Did you enjoy the episode? Follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you prefer listening to your favorite podcast shows. Forward Thinkers is a 48 Forward podcast produced in the 48 Forward Studios in Munich.